Welcome to Gogcast, a long-form discussion podcast about the music of English electronic duo Autechre, album by album, EP by EP. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this episode, we are returning to the topic of live Autechre with AE Live 2016/2018, a batch of soundboard recordings officially released in 2020, but documenting seven shows from the so-called 1-6 tour, which took place in, you guessed it, 2016 and 2018. As we did with the first AE Live, we're going to attempt to discuss this release and tour as a whole, but we think the best way to do that is to zoom in on a few representative highlights, and this time we settled on two: the Helsinki show from November 14th, 2016, and the Dublin show from July 15th, 2018. On that note, I know we're kind of breaking our usual chronological order here by going back to 2016, but since some of these recordings post-date the NTS sessions, and maybe because we're too excited to get to NTS, we thought we'd save this release for today. Next week, we'll do another listener email bonus episode, so you've still got time to tell us what you think about AE Live 2016/2018, gogcastpod@gmail.com. And our next proper episode, 2 weeks from now, will be on Autechre's most recent studio LPs. I'm really excited for this one. I'm sure all you guys are. Sign and Plus. So start sending us your thoughts on those as well. Again, that's gogcastpod@gmail.com. Okay, Dan, I know there isn't a ton of background info for this somewhat overlooked release. We got very few listener emails as well, actually, even though I guess a couple were kind of rolling in over the last couple days. But what do we need to know about AE Live 2016/2018?
Yeah, October 29th, 2016, Autechre embarked on a month-long tour across Europe, which they called 1-6. The 1-6 set was shockingly experimental, and pristine audience recordings from Helsinki and Budapest quickly caused a sensation among fans. In 2018, the guys performed a new variation of this material at a handful of dates in Japan, Australia, and Ireland, but fans would have to wait 2 more years until April 7th, 2020 to get their hands on the 7 soundboard recordings released as AE Live 2016/2018. If the first AE Live is anything to go by, we may get to hear the rest of this tour one day, but for now, this is our most recent look at Autechre's live process. It's also worth noting that the Dublin show, which we'll discuss in detail soon, is the last AE performance to date. There are rumors of a 2020 tour, and Autechre is tentatively scheduled to play at Terraforma 2021 this July, but the pandemic has obviously screwed all of that up.
Yeah, the guys didn't do much press around the tour or even the release of the soundboards, but I was able to dig up a few interesting tidbits. In one interview before the 2018 Japanese show, for instance, the same one we quoted a bunch in our last two episodes on the NTS sessions, actually, they talked about playing a lot of seated concert halls on this tour. And in a 2016 interview on Slovenian radio, they mentioned thinking about, quote, what kinds of music would be good in venues like these when designing the new set. Of the music itself, Sean says, we wanted loud bass and wanted quiet bass. And at the moment, I'm really into depth. So there's some bass that is really here, some bass kind of distant and very quiet, a lot of contrast. And Rob says, I wouldn't call it ambient, but it's slower and kind of intense. It's a lot of curves rather than discrete events. So it sounds smooth and sophisticated, if that's the right word. They also talk about wanting to tease the audience and push the audience. I thought it was particularly interesting how, when talking about NTS in the same interview, they mentioned being nostalgic for their days on pirate radio. And when talking about the tour, they mentioned being nostalgic for the days when they were first discovering early pre-Kraftwerk electronic music. Sean notes, audiences have evolved. People nowadays know who Stockhausen is. When we started out, you'd meet maybe 3 people who know Stockhausen. I think audiences are far more educated and far more flexible. They're exposed to more different things all the time. And I'll throw it back to you, Dan, for the last of this background info section, which is actually a lot longer than I thought it would be.
In regard to reception, I couldn't find any reviews of this release in any major music publications, but fans on Rate Your Music have rated the entire release at a shockingly high 4.16, even though the average of the individual shows is a 3.65. It's worth noting, though, that these shows have very few ratings compared to Autechre's other releases.
Yeah, I always like to ask, you know, what is your sense of this release's reputation among fans, Dan?
You know, this one seems to, like, really fly under the radar. I mean, I know it's newer, yeah. You know, it hasn't even been out, or I guess it's just been about a year since it was released. But, you know, it's sort of, I sort of forget about it, you know? Maybe it's because it gets lumped in with the other AE Live set, but I just feel like, you know, there was the initial excitement on, you know, Reddit and stuff when it first was released, but then I just never really hear anybody talking about it. And in fact, I've been spending a little bit of time in the Autechre Discord lately, and you know, I was asking people if they, you know, if they knew any you know, interviews or anything, you know, that we had overlooked, and everyone sort of was like, yeah, they, you know, it's under the radar, just not a whole lot of information about it.
Yeah, there's something about the like low-key way that it was released that seems to have, you know, resulted in being a little buried, I think, for some fans. The title, I don't think, helps at all. I think a lot of like casual fans probably don't even recognize that this is a different set than the other AE Lives. Also, the fact that it's so much smaller in scope. I mean, that first AE Live, you couldn't not pay attention to because it was like, what? You know, Autechre released 28 hours of stuff. You know, this just feels almost like something like kind of a little bonus thing for fans. But it's so weird because, you know, before this was released, you just heard all this clamor for like 1.6. You know, 1.6 was like so mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. You know, the bootlegs are incredible. It's going to change the world. Like when these soundboards finally come out. And then they came out and like now nobody talks about it for some reason. But
yeah, that is the strangest thing, because I do remember, you know, everyone before this, you know, always begging, like, release the tapes, you know, and stuff. And then they did. And then it just sort of seemed like no one cared that much.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, of course, and what we could sort of transition into our personal histories with this release at this point. The other thing we're forgetting to mention is the fucking pandemic, of course, which may have just buried, you know, anything that came out. You know, this came out in April, like right as the pandemic was started. So maybe, you know, it wasn't like first and foremost in a lot of people's minds, and they haven't gotten back around to it yet. But I can sort of say that that's what happened to me. And not because of anything with the like pandemic directly, but honestly, like my then girlfriend, now wife, started working from home at that time, and I just couldn't be playing like this crazy experimental shit on my speakers all day like I normally would have if this came out like in a normal year. And so I listened to it like as much as I could with headphones and stuff, and but still I was kind of feeling like when we got around to this week, like I never spent enough time with it, because I was always kind of waiting for her to go back to work and she still hasn't, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, my experience is pretty much the same. You know, in April, both my wife and I were working from home, and you know, I spend most of my listening on my speakers at work, which you know, I didn't do because my wife's a teacher, so you know, she had to talk on Zoom and everything, so really couldn't play any music. And you know, I would listen in headphones, but I mean, to be honest, that early in the pandemic and stuff, like I didn't really want to listen to like things that were more challenging. You know, it was just, it was kind of a shitty time, which I'm, you know, preaching to, you know, the choir for everyone who's listening, you know, but, you know, I just didn't, I was excited when it came out and I listened to them, and I just sort of was like, I'll get back to that when this is over.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still not over.
I know. Yeah, I did want to ask real quick if you ever checked out those bootlegs before this came out. I'll say that I'm just not like a bootleg kind of guy. I understood that they were probably going to be releasing this soon. That was like general consensus. And I was like, you know what? I'll wait for these like perfect soundboards. I mean, I definitely listened to it a little bit, like especially the Budapest one. But I was kind of waiting. Were you like big in the bootlegs at all?
No, I, you know, there's certain like artists where I've followed tours and gotten real into bootlegs and stuff. Like, I always do that with like Godspeed and, you know, some other people and stuff. But I never really got into the like Autechre ones, which honestly, I've kind of regretted, you know, in the midst of doing this podcast, since we have gone over some of these bootlegs. And I was thinking just earlier today, I was kind of looking and, you know, I'm going to find all the bootlegs I can find it and get into it. But no, I had never listened to any of the 1.6 bootlegs or anything until they were released, you know, in this set.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's start with the big picture stuff before we zoom in on Helsinki and Dublin. Without referencing Sean and Rob's descriptions, which we'll talk about in a second, I want to hear how you would describe the overall sound of the 1.6 sets. You know, what sound palette are Autechre working with on this tour?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a different palette than the other AE Live, you know, set. Mm-hmm. It's a much more like complicated palette, a much more, you know, sort of electroacoustic kind of sound.
Yeah.
You know, definitely more in the vein of like NTS4 than previous things, especially, you know, the previous AE live set. I sort of expected it to be a bit more like the, you know, first AE live sets than they are. Yeah. You know, it's really like completely different.
Yeah, it's like a huge shift, and it is kind of similar to NTS4. And I want to get back to that a little bit later, but just in the sense that, you know, it's like ambient, but not ambient. You know, like Rob in that interview I was quoting earlier when he's talking about, like, I wouldn't call it ambient. He had this little aside where he was like, you know, I understand, like, with oversteps, a lot of people started calling it ambient because they didn't know what else to call it. And I get that. And people will probably say the same thing about this tour. And a lot of people do, you know, they use words like ambient and drone and like electroacoustic, but there's something kind of unique that, yeah, I do think you kind of hear on places in NTS4 where it's like electroacoustic, like music concrete kind of compositions, but they're kind of like blended in a way that is like something like ambient. I mean, this is why I have a hard time like picking a you know, clean genre name or something, because it's got a very like lush, almost like melodic quality to it. You know, like Parmigiani or something, but just like turned into like this lush soundscape. But if you really look into it, none of the sounds are like particularly lush. You know what I mean? They're all like quite dry, like feedbacky, you know, music concrete type sounds, but somehow it's all coalesced into like this soupy thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good description. You know, it is hard to describe because it's such a weird thing. I mean, when you say like electroacoustic, you know, I don't think anything here is like actually acoustic. You know, it's just sort of,
because you think of like harsh and grating, like shrill noises.
Yeah,
when you hear that. You
know? It's just sort of like that. You know, that composition style maybe. But then again, I mean, like you just said, a lot of times when you think of that, you know, early, you know, pre-Kraftwerk electronic music, a lot of times it's more of a you know, experiment and like almost a show of technology than you know, something that like is generally you know, like enjoyable to listen to in like a song sense. You know, it's more of like an academic thing than a you know, a pop music kind of thing. And I feel like, you know, you get sort of those sounds in this tour, but it's like coalesced in this way where it is like fairly enjoyable and like put together, where it's much more like to the average person, I think it's much more like listenable or interesting than that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely like more accessible than that, but we're not like, I don't think even close to the realm of accessible, you know, in any sense.
Yeah,
it is still like totally bizarre. It feels like very amorphous, and you know, there's this kind of like, I kept going back and forth on this because there's kind of a stillness to it, you know, which is why people throw the word drone around a lot when they talk about this set. But at the same time, it kind of feels like pulsating in this, like I wrote down, like I compared it to like a boat rocking, you know, like the boat is not moving, but it's still it's moving a lot, you know, because of the water is making it kind of rock all around. And it has that like kind of steadiness and like forward drive, even though if you were kind of like 3 feet away, it feels like it's not moving for an entire hour, pretty much.
Yeah, I think that's a good good descriptor of it. In fact, I mean, I think like in my first like kind of listens, when I was not really, you know, paying close attention, you know, I just had it on while reading or something, I did sort of feel like, you know, this is such like kind of a stationary set. But as I got more into it, you know, and especially like in focusing on, you know, two shows, and listening in headphones and you know, paying much more attention, you see that it does sort of have like a velocity to it. But yeah, I mean, it like you said, it's sort of in that like relativistic way. It's like to one observer, it's moving, and to another, it's you know, stationary.
Yeah. So let me bring Sean and Rob back into it at this point. What do you think about their references to like lots of bass and depth, and their descriptions of the music as, again, not exactly ambient, but quote, a lot of curves rather than discrete events?
I mean, I like the a lot of curves rather than discrete events as a descriptor, because it it's like that. You know, I think that's a good like way to sum up what we were just talking about how like it's sort of moving, but in this, you know, obscure kind of way, which, you know, is more of a curve than, you know, I think in the other AE Live sets, you know, there was often like, if you wanted to break it into a track list, you know, it was sort of obvious at points like, okay, we're moving to a new thing here. I think
there would be like a pause and then like a hard reset.
Exactly. Basically. Yeah. Exactly. Like a hard reset. I don't think we get many of those hard resets here. You know, there's a couple like moments where, you know, that like sort of organ thing happens, you know, which had been in the other sets and stuff. And like, that's really that. And maybe a couple other like little moments are there like a left turn or a hard reset that you would say like, yeah, split the track here if we're making like a, you know, a regular album kind of thing. But for the most part, these sets are like very much, you know, an hour to, you know, whatever hour 20 piece of music.
Yeah. There are a couple of those curveballs, which we will talk about more, of course. But yeah, for the most part, it has like this kind of long arc kind of a quality to it. And, you know, what's striking to me is like there's, you know, so we'll get into this too in more detail later. But you hear stuff like Shim Ripple Casual appear here. You know, in the 2018 sets, you hear like a little Column 13, a couple little pieces here and there and stuff. But like even those tracks somehow get like subsumed into this larger piece. And it almost feels like when I'm listening to this, they're like every song is a transition from the last one into the next one. You know what I mean? Like I could sort of hear like where something sort of shifted, like a new, you know, bass beat kind of like, you know, bubbled in or something like that. And I would call that a track split, but it's not really obvious. And then the thing that happens before the next sort of shift is not like enough to ever call it like, oh, that was a clear track. You kind of know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. I think your description of like every track is sort of a transition into the next track and the track before it is really, you know, like apt. It's that curve rather than discrete events. I think that's exactly what they're talking about here.
Yeah, and on the previous note about lots of bass and depth, I mean, holy shit, that's, you know, the first thing you're going to notice here, I think, is the extreme amount of low end. It's almost bizarre. Like, if you really think about it, there sometimes they break this rule in pretty notable places, but there's like almost never a snare sound or a hi-hat sound or something. It's almost like just kicks, you know what I mean? Like really low, like booming kick drums or something. Sometimes they're like kind of, you know, tighter and like a little more muffled and not so heavy, but it's like, you know, it becomes more of a pulse when you do that. But it's also weird because it's like, I don't know, if you're listening to a beat and you were just listening to the kick drum, you know how it's like, it would be kind of hard to find and follow the beat in that, and if that's all you had of the entire kit, you know what I mean? And so there's just lots of like low end groaning kind of sounds and just kicks all the way through it, like almost, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, Western music is built on the snare on the 2 and 4. And, you know, when you basically don't ever have that, it does make you sort of, you know, that's the how most people find their footing and stuff in music. And you're right. Yeah, it basically never does that. It's almost all bass, you know, kick drum. It's definitely like an interesting, you know, way to do it. Cause I mean, it's not even like, oh, you know, it's like a all toms or, you know, the snares are off on the snare. It's like, it's mostly kick drums, you know?
Yeah.
It's really crazy.
Yeah. And like long stretches with no kick, but then when you do get a beat, it's like just the kick and it's like such a weird arrangement. Like it just sounds like there's this, like a huge heaviness to it, but also like a immense kind of cosmic sparseness to the whole thing. What do you make of the fact that they seem to have designed this set with seated concert halls in mind? I think that's so like fascinating. I mean, you mentioned the word academic earlier, and it's just so funny because like doing this podcast and like reading stuff about Autechre all these months and months, you know, there's like this constant kind of debate about like, at the end of the day, this is dance music, you know, no matter how weird it gets, it's meant to be dance music. It's meant to like move your body no matter how brainy it gets. And yet, you know, this seems to be a seated concert hall kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't know that. You do most of the, or you do all the research for the podcast. And so, you know, until you sent me, you know, the beginning of your little outline that we always read, I didn't realize that this was, you know, written with the intention of the seated concert hall in mind. And to be honest, once I read that, it really sort of like opened up the shows for me. It was the key, yeah, key that, you know, unlocked these sets, because I was like, at first I was kind of thinking, I was like, man, you know, these shows would be like a little weird to be at, but right. It, you know, when in your mind, when you sit down, oh, now it's like completely normal. And you know, it feels like the, you know, I'm sure Stockhausen wasn't playing, you know, at the club. Right. You know, he was playing at the, you know, University Hall and everything. And that, you know, that really seems like, I mean, I think it's so like cool and interesting that they, you know, take that sort of thing in consideration, you know, like to write a set like specifically because, you know, this tour's hitting, you know, seated places, and this one's, you know, a place where people can dance and stuff. You know, I mean, the old sets, like those, you know, like the show I saw and stuff, you know, we're in a regular old, you know, concert venue where you see, you know, rock acts and stuff too. It's really like interesting that they, you know, that they care enough to like retool like a whole live set, like just for, you know, the environment that it's in.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's like a chicken or the egg situation, because it might be that they were kind of interested in doing something like this, yeah, and they knew that they couldn't take it to clubs, you know, so let's like plan a tour that goes to a lot of seated places. But, you know, in that like Slovenian radio interview that I was listening to, he's saying something like, yeah, you know, we came to this place that's in town here, and it was one of the venues that we started thinking about when we started planning this, like as if they went back home, you know, wiped the slate clean, and we're just like, where would we want to play this, and what kind of music would be cool to play there? You know, and it's just so interesting because it feels like their entire career is thinking about like the dance club and like pushing that into new territory. And then this is like the one time almost that they were just like, you know what, let's go like full Stockhausen. But, you know, on that note, listener Joe wrote in to say, it's been mentioned countless times by you, listeners, and many others that hip-hop is a key ingredient that makes Autechre so unique among their colleagues. And I think that what makes 1/6 stand out so much is that it feels like this is the first time they've ever completely abandoned it for such a long stretch. I want to know if you agree with that, but also what you think about their apparent inspiration from early electronic music, as we were talking about. Fittingly, we also got an email from listener Eric who says the sets remind him, quote, less of electro and more of early modular synth music like Morton Subotnick and Wendy Carlos. So do you hear that and do you dig it?
To the first question, you know, the hip hop, this is sort of strangely, I agree. Like it is sort of the first time I feel like it's been maybe fully abandoned, or at least not, or at least, you know, mostly abandoned. Mm. And to the other listener, yeah, I mean, definitely like these sets, I think we've already hinted at it, you know, remind me a lot less of electro and more of that modular synth. You know, the people, I think Wendy Carlos is maybe a little late, you know, she is the person I think that's, you know, most responsible for making the synthesizer, you know, like a real normal instrument. You know, she played it in a way that made it sound like something that was usable and not just like quirky sound effects and stuff. So I don't think they're sort of going before, you know, even pre-Carlos here, you know. But like, yeah, I mean, Morton Subotnick and stuff, you know, it definitely sounds like that. You know, it's this thing, you know, there's the little section and it's like that real, like, you know, bubbly sort of noise. You know, that is such like an early, you know, pre-Kraftwerk, pre-Wendy Carlos, you know, synth trick, you know, like it was... Before the Moog, you know, you could not make like that watery noise, you know, without like recording water. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and there's lots of stuff here that just sounds like almost pure sine wave type stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, which like does make me think of that early electronic music and stuff that's just like, just really just sounds like computers like blipping or something like that. And lots of that, you know, we mentioned all like the low end, but there is lots of this like, you know, just blipping and whooshing and stuff that really just sounds like pure experimentation on early equipment, you know, like Pauline Oliveros or Subotnick or any of these people. You know, does it seem sort of contradictory that they talk about wanting to push the audience on this tour, but also that they can expect audiences to be more flexible and receptive to this kind of stuff? Like, are they trying to, you know, quote, tease and be and provoke or not?
I don't know. I mean, I just feel like the person that's going to an Autechre concert, especially in 2016 or 2018, I think it is probably receptive to this experimentation. And like, you know, that quote you read, like, you know, before they might see three people who knew Stockhausen, and today, you know, everyone does. So I don't know if it's like really that much of a provocation.
Yeah, it's weird because it like, I don't know, sometimes when they were talking about it in these interviews I was reading, like, you know, it had that kind of like trolley quality, like something like the kind of like, I don't know, teasing that they were doing with the NTS sessions where it's like, hey, everybody's going to be expecting a DJ mix and it's going to blow their minds as it slowly dawns on them, mm-hmm. you know, what they're hearing. You know, it kind of sounds like something like that, like, okay, everybody's going to come to the Autechre show and it's going to like really rock, you know, rock them to, you know, sit through this kind of electroacoustic experimentation. But yeah, it doesn't feel like a troll, you know, it feels like this is maybe something they always wanted to do. And they were kind of feeling like,
yeah,
hey, you know what? Audiences are ready for this kind of thing. And we could actually go this direction for once.
It's like it's not like they've never touched on this subject before. You know, I mean,
yeah,
this is not the first podcast that we've mentioned Stockhausen. You know, they've always sort of like touched on it, you know, like I don't think they've ever, I mean, like that, the one listener said they've never like really like completely abandoned the hip hop element, which, you know, always sort of kept it grounded in the dance club, even, you know, throughout these moments and sounds that were, you know, very experimental. Here, you know, I think they do at least mostly get abandon that and go, you know, full academic and stuff, but like, yeah, how full, you know, it's not like people showed up to see you know, Coldplay and they got this, you know what I mean? Like it's I think it's still in line with them. It's just maybe a step or two more than you would expect.
Yeah, it would still probably be a shock, but it's like, you know, I feel like they came at this in good faith. Like, people are gonna be, you know, it's gonna shock them, but they're gonna love it, you know, is probably where I think this is. Also wanted to read this though from listener Joe, who says, at first I had no idea what people were talking about when they described the music as funky, but after listening more, I can tell that there is definitely a groove in there among all the electroacoustic-ish bubbly noises. Do you hear anything funky or groovy here at all?
I mean, it's definitely like harder to pinpoint than in the past and stuff, but I mean, I think it's because it's obscured in the like reduction of the drum sounds, like we were talking about earlier. You know, it's like mostly this kick drum thing, and I mean, definitely you can pick up the beat sometimes. It's just maybe takes a little bit more work, and I mean, I think that's something that, like, you know, most early electroacoustic and stuff, like, you know, the drum machine didn't really exist yet. So it's mostly devoid of any sort of like groove or funkiness, yeah, and stuff. So like, I mean, it's definitely, you know, it's not like they're just completely going back in time and being, you know, like, you know, it's 1961 here, you know, I mean, they're definitely using like modern equipment and modern technique. And so I think that definitely like there is, some of that funkiness to be found, but it's definitely, I think you have to look for it a little harder than in past sets.
Yeah. I think that like a while ago, I would not have agreed with this, but after like spending so much time with it these past 2 weeks, I do kind of hear all this like underneath, but it, like you were just saying, it's like so de-emphasized that it's weird. Like, you can miss it. You know, like in the beginning section of the Dublin set, for example, there's like all these kind of drippy, like, noises, and like these kind of like woozy rubbery sounds sort of join in, and some like light beeping and stuff, and there's like this huge, you know, something like a cello groan going over the top of it, but all this like kind of blipping becomes like this nice little like groove that I kind of compared it in my notes to like a bongo groove, like a bongo jam going on here. It's just so like underneath this like big wall of just groaning like and tinkering sounds and stuff. I don't know. You could just like sort of miss how groovy that is. And there's lots of times where like this big, like, you know, bouncy kind of bass sound is like, you know, popping around in the thing. And, you know, at first you like can't find the beat, but then there might be like some little blipping that like kind of helps you figure out what the pattern is. And I don't know, you just kind of realize you've been listening to something kind of groovy for like 6 minutes without realizing it was groovy.
But isn't it sort of strange? Because, you know, we talk about like, you know, the first time you listen to it, you might not notice that. It sort of like requires, you know, deep listening and repeated listening. But these, you know, let's not forget, are live sets that, you know, sort of you were only supposed to hear one time. So that is sort of like... That's a bit strange, you know?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's something that I want to talk about more a little bit later, but it's like in reading about this, you know, because we didn't get any listeners like who wrote in who like saw it firsthand or anything. So I was kind of just like scouring the internet for any like firsthand accounts and stuff. And, you know, what kept coming up is like these soundboards do not capture like the hugeness of the bass sound that they experienced. Mm-hmm. Same thing with like those big organ drones. Like they don't capture just how overwhelmingly huge those felt in the moment. And I just felt like you're not going to hear it unless you listen very closely. But maybe if you were there, you could kind of feel that bass bounce like in sort of a, you know, like in your gut kind of like subconscious way. And it would feel like it had that forward momentum that you actually have to dig for if you're listening on headphones.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I didn't really think about that. Like, yeah, you know, I spent most time listening on a Bluetooth speaker or, you know, some crappy headphones. And yeah, I mean, in a PA, I think that deep bass would be, you know, definitely more apparent. And yeah, you're right. I think it's sort of easier to find that beat and that rhythm when you, you know, have it where it's pounding you in the chest. You know, I mean, that's the reason, you know, live music is fun. Yeah.
You just feel it. You don't even have to think about it.
Yeah.
And that's it. Okay. So listener Eric also wrote, I see these sets as almost the opposites to the 2014, 2015 ones, where those were hard hitting, abrasive and dense. These ones are subtle and atmospheric with less focus on rhythm and more focus on lush soundscapes. Listener Joe also wrote, the jump between the 2015 set and the 1.6 set is just nuts to me. It's like upgrading from Windows 98 to Windows 10 in terms of the complexity of the sound design. So how do you think the 1.6 sets compare and contrast with the previous AE Live? You already started touching on this earlier, but do you see them as like complete and maybe even intentional opposites?
I mean, they're definitely, you know, far apart. I don't know if I would say they're like 100% opposite or anything, but I mean, it's definitely, you know, more focus on sound design rather than, you know, dancing. But I don't want to imply that the 2014, 2015 set didn't have its share of, you know, sound design and everything. You know, it's definitely there. It's just, I think it's just presents itself in a different way. You know, I don't think it's like going from 98 to Windows 10, you know, maybe it's going from 7 to 10 or something, you know. It's definitely different and everything, but I don't think it's that, you know, big of a world apart, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to say that the club and the concert hall are opposites, then yes, I mean, technically they're still both music venues, so like I don't know, you know, they're not like total opposites, but in the terms of music, you know what I mean, like they might be like opposite ends of the spectrum in some way.
Yeah,
but I mean, I do agree that like the 2015 AE Live is, it's just a much more like visceral kind of bodily experience than this. We were just talking about how like the you know, bass in your gut might play some part, but it almost feels like here it's more to just sort of anchor you so that you can like focus on the things that are going on around you. It just felt like with AE Live, it would be like these blasts of like aggressive noise and you were kind of just supposed to let go, like stop, you know, trying to like find every little particle that's fluttering around your head and like echoing around this room, like just feel it and like jump around or whatever. This really feels like it's just signaling the complete opposite instructions. You know what I mean? It's just like, hey, sit and focus, you know, zero in on the stuff that's flittering around you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we've kind of said it, but I think 2014, 2015 was more body and this one's, you know, more mind. You know, this is the more, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, sort of sounding set.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, I mean, it's perfectly possible as we've sort of uncovered in doing this like discography deep dive is like, a lot of Autechre's next move is like a direct reaction against their previous move.
Yeah, and definitely.
I could fully believe if like they got home from the 2015 tour and were like, let's do the opposite of that. You know, like maybe not any condemnation of what they just did, but just like it would be fun to do the complete opposite of that.
I think that's why they're still going after, you know, all these years and like still releasing interesting music. And I think, you know, a lot of people would agree, you know, some of their best music now, you know, what's it been 30 years into the into their career. I think it's because they do stuff like that. You know, you don't get bored when you come home and you say, you know, remember what we did last year? Let's do the opposite of it. You know, like I think it keeps you, you know, engaged and on your toes and stuff. And I mean, clearly they enjoy doing this. And so it's probably keeps it fun. I mean, cause they could have rode the 2014, I mean the 2014-15 set, they easily could have rode that into the 2016 tour. They could have ran it into 2018. I mean, they didn't even play at the same venues. You know, it's not like these people had already heard those sets and stuff. Right. You know what I mean? They easily could have done that for years, you know. I mean, they could still play that, you know, 2021, you know, and nobody would complain. But it's cool that they don't, and I think like a big reason of why they, you know, are still interesting today.
Yeah, I agree. This might be a good time to talk just briefly about the 1/6 artwork, which the Designers Republic describe as deep universes printed black hole and space black. Is it meant to contrast with the previous AE Live artwork? And what do you think about the aesthetics here in general?
I think it is sort of a contrast of the previous ones. You know, it's like similar enough where, you know, you could tell it's maybe, you know, the same sort of like series or something. You know, these ones are like much, the 2014-2015 sets are like a white background with black shapes. And these are more of like mostly black with like sort of a white shape. You know, some of them are a little different than that, but it definitely like contrasts. But I think it's like close enough that you can, you know, that you could think of them as like a separate but continuation of, you know, like a series. You know, if this was like the Grateful Dead's dick pics or something, you know, like it's got that sort of like feel to it. I think I like these covers. I like the 2014-15 ones a bit better, but these ones are definitely you know, pretty cool. It looks like, you know, every cover we're seeing those the same two, you know, dots, or you know, if they're black holes, they're like moving throughout the frames of each of these, you know, like I don't know, the binary, you know, black holes orbiting each other or something. It's cool.
Yeah, I just think it's like fascinating how it's like now rounded shapes and like shading on them and stuff, and it's just like such a, I don't know, provocative kind of like commentary on the earlier AE Live artwork. You know, on that note, I wanted to read this from listener Joe, who says, in terms of the artwork, I love how there seems to be a progression from Oversteps to Sign. With Oversteps, we have the beginning of the geometric shape era, where we have the famous imperfect circles in just black and white. With LSEC and AE Live, we get the digital perfect shapes still in black and white, and they are still orderly and distinct. With the 1/6 artwork, we still have round black and white shapes, but they are far more fluid and now in shades of gray instead of just black and white, which perfectly reflects the fluidity of the music. With Sign and Plus, we get even more complex round shapes, and color is finally reintroduced into their art for the first time since 2008. I mean, mentioning like Oversteps there, it kind of got me thinking about like, is there any deeper meaning between like behind when Autechre used rounder shapes? You know what I mean? It just seems like, I don't know if that's even a good question, but it's just like they're using like these more like imperfect shapes here, and it just feels like a little bit more like human or more like fluid sounds, or, you know, like, are they trying to signal something? Because when I think about like the 2014-2015 AE Live covers and the music there, it does feel like these really jagged edges and everything like that. And this is much more like circular, and you know what I mean?
I think the Designers Republic, you know, basically does the artwork. We've read some quotes and stuff where they sort of do it, you know, and not with much direction and stuff. So I don't know how much, you know, Autechre themselves are trying to signal something or anything. I think it might just be that Designers Republic likes round shapes.
Yeah, well, I mean, and they might be, I mean, I know from what I've read, it's like sometimes they get a little more instruction than other times, but it does kind of feel like they're just like good listeners of Autechre's music.
Yeah, exactly.
Hear, they hear when like round shapes are more appropriate than jagged shapes.
I think that's definitely a benefit of like working with the same like yeah. you know sets of designers, you know, for the most part, throughout a career. You end up with like you know, a consistent artwork feel. You know, like it becomes like a full aesthetic package, rather than yeah. you know the music and the artwork sometimes being you know different and separated.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I just feel like they nailed it here because there's something like so evocative about like just the shadowy nature of these covers and the way it does feel like it's too zoomed in, you know, like you can't see, you know, enough of like what this is to figure out what it is. It just feels like so appropriate for the music. More big picture stuff. How would you describe the relationship between 1.6 and NTS4? Would you say, you know, you talked about this earlier, but is it like basically the same vibe or are there important differences?
You know, I think it's like a similar vibe. It's definitely like different. You know, Autechre never seems to be one to just repeat themselves or, you know, obviously they don't just play album tracks live. Even, you know, there's some instances that you mentioned, you know, little snippets and stuff. I think it's in a similar vein, you know, is sort of, I would say it's like a progression from 4, but, you know, all in sort of, you know, throws that out. Cause you know, we don't get anything that's just that pure, sort of drone here. I don't think, but everything, you know, before All In, I think this is sort of like a progression. This is like, honestly, if Sign sounded like these records sound, I wouldn't have been surprised. And I would have, you know, everyone, you know, myself and most of the people I read, you know, sort of think of like Sign and Plus as like the beginning of this new era, because it sort of feels like another reset. And so, you know, like this sort of feels like maybe the last you know progression from that style of that previous era we were in.
Yeah, it's hard because I want to say it sounds a lot like NTS4, but not All End and not Frame Casual and not Mirage.
So not most of the record.
Basically just the two tracks that are literally here and performed on these sets. So, you know, maybe that's just a fool's errand. The other thing I can't quite figure out is like, I want to say that NTS4 is like just so much more defined, you know, like you're never going to confuse Shim Ripple Casual with Column 13. They sound completely different from each other. And here it just sounds like this constantly like evolving kind of ooze to where, you know, you don't even like realize when Shim Ripple starts, like the kind of like lead in is so smooth and they just feel like so tangled together. But the problem is, you know, I mentioned earlier about feeling like most of the tracks are just transitions. They're like they're on their way somewhere, they're like tied in with the previous track already. And then I think like, okay, but this is obviously Shim Ripple or this is obviously Column 13. And I think like, do I only think that because I already know those tracks separate from this? I don't even know if this question makes sense, but it's like maybe it's not accurate to say that NTS4 is like more cleanly divided. It's just that they have track, you know, delineations, so I think they are. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, I get what you mean. You know, like you're able to delineate those two sections in these AE Live things because you have seen the delineations in this.
And if I had heard the, like, whatever the original track was of some of the other pieces here, I would be like, oh, yeah, those are, like, clearly distinct tracks. But for some reason, I think of this as, like, 1 hour-long stretch of music, give or take.
No, yeah, definitely. I understand what you mean.
Yeah, so I don't know, kind of a mystery, but I do feel like even things that we might call distinct tracks here are like so tangled together over like such long stretches. Not like on NTS4 where it's just sometimes a little crossfade or something. It's like just totally interwoven into one big piece of music, one big tapestry. The other thing I kind of want to mention, I forgot to mention earlier, is like in regard to NTS in general, would it be accurate to say that like if you loved the kind of interlude-y tracks throughout, like scattered throughout NTS, like, you know, PLMA and you know, Shim Ripple AB Air and that kind of stuff, like this is the music for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably good. Yeah,
there's probably few people like that, but I just felt like it kind of feels like I'm listening to an hour long of those kind of weirder detours throughout the NTS sessions. Any thoughts on the set's connection to even earlier Autechre material? I thought it was interesting that listener Jordan argued that 1/6, quote, sounds like the sound and aesthetic AE got to after finding it in LSEC. AE Live sounds like the beginnings of this LSEC style, but 1/6 sounds like what they became. While listener Joe wrote, it's difficult for me to remember that the 2016 tour happened just months after LSEC and that the 2018 dates were just weeks after NTS aired. It's amazing how radically different both the sound palette and approach are, not only to virtually anything on LSEC, but also most of NTS sessions aside from parts of session 4. So how do you see 1/6 fitting into Autechre's discography? Is it like a natural progression from the stuff they were doing in 2016-ish, or are we just like a totally uncharted territory?
It is kind of crazy. I mean, I think I just said, you know, it sort of feels like a bit of a progression from NTS-4, you know, before we get into this new current era. But yeah, I didn't think about it. It's actually like sort of just right after LSEC and before NTS. That sort of puts a little bit of a wrinkle in that theory, I guess. I'm not sure.
It feels totally weird because it feels like, and I feel like this is part of the 1/6 legend that started pretty quickly, is even though it was like contemporaneous pretty much with LSEC, and obviously stuff here like ended up on NTS, it feels like this weird glimpse into like the future. It feels like you're looking at like the logical endpoint of Autechre or something. And there was something about like that shadowy, like audience recording only nature of the thing for those couple of years there, where it just like, you know what I mean? It kind of felt like this is like 100 years, you know, further from anything that they've done yet, you know, and we're just getting like a little taste of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think if you had listened to these bootlegs, you know, as they came out and stuff, and you heard them before NTS, I think, you know, that's a good way. I didn't really ever think of it like that. You know, I'm kind of hearing it backwards. It is like a glimpse in the future. It, because of the like release order, it doesn't feel like that forward looking. But I can see that for sure.
Yeah, because I understand how they got here when I'm listening to like LSEC and NTS and stuff, but it's still just, for me, like this, whose side I would have to take here is like, it just feels like something like such a huge, like radical departure in some weird way. Mm-hmm. All right. Last big picture question before we finally get into the nitty gritty. What do you think about the methods of release in regard to AE Live and now 1/6? Obviously, this batch is more like the first batch of AE Live, you know, which was just like 4 and then 9 selections from the European leg of the tour. But then we got the entire North American leg in full, which kind of changed the way I think, you know, that we like think about AE Live as a release. So does the 1/6 batch have the same, you know, let's hear how things change night to night thing going on? Or is this more of like a listen to one at a time thing? You know what I mean?
I definitely feel like it was listen one at a time. I feel like it's so, you know, kind of dense and, you know, academic that it, you know, when as I first started just going through the whole set, when we did 2014, 2015, you know, I listened to 2 or 3 of them, you know, back to back at work or something. And it wasn't that, you know, taxing or anything. But these ones,
yeah.
I mean, also, you know, we had 23 hours or whatever to get through in the same amount of time as we had, you know, to get through these ones. So I sort of had to do that. But, you know, these ones, yeah. I sort of like, I would listen to one, and then either, you know, that would be it for that day at work. And then, you know, maybe I'd listen to one more at night or something. But I did find myself like definitely stretching out in between. I mean, like today, in anticipation for recording, you know, I listened to like Helsinki and then Dublin, you know, kind of back to back. And it was honestly like, you know, kind of taxing and not like the greatest listening experience.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, because I remember commenting on the earlier AE Live that it is a little exhausting. I mean, you can kind of like go back to back to back, but you kind of shouldn't. Like, you should take a breather in between them because it's like such an overwhelming experience. But here it's like almost impossible to go back to back to back, I think. It is so much more taxing, like on a mental level. And, you know, I was going to ask, like, if the little changes are, like, as inviting and exciting as they seem to be on AE Live. Because I feel like you start listening to AE Live and you can, if you just sample a couple, you can, like, immediately tell that things are changing, you know? And then you're like, oh, I want to hear how they got there. this, I just don't think it like does that, because you're never going to know it well enough to recognize that things are different because of that like long, long arc of change that we were talking about earlier. Like, you are never gonna, you know, like, it was so obvious on the first AE Live, like, whoa, they played that for like 10 minutes on the previous show. Now all of a sudden they're playing it for 3 minutes. Like, you are never going to zero in on those kind of details, you know?
No, exactly. I mean, you know, honestly, when we first started listening to these ones, I kind of thought that, like, you know, this episode would be super hard to do because, you know, it is sort of hard to night, you know, to tell there's much difference. I mean, even between, like I said, I listened to Helsinki and then Dublin, you know, kind of back to back today. And, you know, Dublin is like the longest show, but it's not like so readily apparent, like what's different between, you know, between the two, and stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, the shows that we didn't zero in on, you know, I only listened to, you know, a time or two. I mean, those ones, it's just almost a complete, you know, blur as to what's what or what was different, you know, between each one.
Yeah, because I feel like, you know, I make it a point to like listen to this shit so much as we prepare for the episode that I'll be able to remember all those little details and stuff. And I just like couldn't, like, I mean,
yeah,
I can tell some obvious things that change, but it's like, it's just, I'm never, you know, I hear stuff like, cause you know, like things get shuffled, as we'll discuss, like in the 2018 sets, but it's like, you hear stuff and you're like, was that earlier in the first set or was it later? Like you it's just like, you can't wrap your mind around it because it is just such like this too long arc of, yeah.
No, I mean, I'm glad to hear you say that. You know, sometimes, you know, I get like that, like imposter syndrome, you know, it's like, I don't know anything about these sets, you know, like, I feel like I need another 2 weeks to digest them and stuff. Yeah. So, I mean,
I feel like there's a certain impenetrability, is that the word, to these that, you know, it's just never going to go away.
I mean, even
part of the fun.
I feel like these ones are even difficult to take notes for because, I found it hard to, you know, how do you write down what the bubble, you know, this bubble sounds
right,
like,
right.
You know, I mean, you could say the bubbly noise, but, you know, there's eight other different bubbly noises and stuff, you know?
Yeah. And they have such like a amorphous quality that I'll be like writing down like, oh, now, you know, this sound is starting to come into play and take over. And then I'm like, oh, never mind. It disappeared. And like that happens over and over again. And there's lots of stuff that like, you know, this feels, we've talked about this before and we talked about it in the context of the first AE Live, but this sounds really like a laboratory in some places. Mm-hmm. Like they're just experimenting in real time and you hear stuff like start to kind of coalesce, like these weird bubbly sounds and stuff. And it's like starting to form and then it just sort of like dissipates like before your eyes. And you're like, was that like an aborted idea? You know, like why they didn't feel like it was done yet or whatever. There's just like lots of stuff like that just makes it like, I don't know, so easy to get lost because it's not like you're moving from track to track.
Definitely. I was thinking like during listening to some of these, like how do they communicate with each other?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's dark on stage, so I don't know, maybe they just whisper back and forth, but I mean, it's loud. It's got to be hard to hear each other. I like wonder like, do they, you know, or do they just like have AIM open or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, all right, let's bail on this. You know, I really do. I really am curious how they communicate what to do between, you know, during these sets and stuff. Because yeah, you're right. Like there are points in this one where, you know, an idea seems to begin forming or something and then either seems aborted or just, you know, was a short idea or something. It's really like miraculous that two people are involved here, you know?
Yeah. You know, so, and I, the last point I wanted to make is that I feel like it also makes a big difference that we don't get to hear the first set yet, you know, with the 2014, yeah. 2015, you hear Krakow and that is like your master key. And then, cause that was like the first show in actually a number of years. And that's the set. And then you compare the other sets against it. Like, oh, here's how it's changing and evolving from Krakow. Here it's like, we just sort of start like, you know, a few dates, like a handful of dates into the tour and we get a few like interspersed things. And obviously you can compare and contrast like 2016 and 2018, but you can't just have that like starting point necessarily. Maybe we will someday. I mean, that's the last question I want to ask you is, like, do you think we'll get more of this tour? And if we did, how would that, like, change the way people think about this set?
I mean, I think having that first show, like, is sort of the master key. I feel like, you know, the first show in a tour, you know, basically for anybody is the closest one you're going to get to, like, you know, rehearsal was, you know, I mean, you haven't been touring it, you know, so it hasn't had like time to morph and change and stuff. So it's nice to have that first show. I mean, I just, if they're going to release, you know, however many got released it in the 2014-2015 set, you know, I feel like you've sort of set a precedent for yourself, especially, you know, if you want to just release one and call it, you know, the 1-6, you know, live album, you know, you could move away from that. But I feel like when you release nine of them, you know, what's the difference in releasing 9 hours of music and releasing, you know, 15 or however many dates were on this tour? I kind of like, and they did it with the first set, you know, releasing it like in these like smaller batches, because it does like, it does sort of like force you to, you know, sit with these ones for a bit of time. And then, you know, you get the second drop and then, you know, you sit with those and you know, so on and so forth. So I kind of hope that we get more. I mean, I feel like you can't ever have too many of them. Yeah, exactly. you know, it would be nice if, you know, they put these on Spotify and, you know, and drop the new ones or something. That's sort of what they did with the first, you know, chunk as well.
But it's just interesting that, like, with the first one, we got basically some, like, selection from the European leg, and then they gave us the whole American leg, or North American leg. You know, here, it's, like, we already got a preview of the whole tour. We have the last show.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, Dublin. So we got 2016 and 2018. It feels just more of, like, almost like this is all they're going to release.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's meant to kind of sum up the tour in some way. You know, so I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't get more, but I would certainly love to hear more. But like, if they release more, like, I pray to God that people listening here have spent some time with these ones, because you're going to be so fucking overwhelmed if you have like 20 hours of this shit.
Yeah, definitely. You
know, do the work now. And the last thing I wanted to mention is, like, I think the other difference between AE Live and, you know, we debated about this a little bit, but it's like, you know, people like to say the AE Live 2014-2015, you can hear them maybe responding to the audience or like the vibe in the room and changing and stuff. I mean, with seated concert halls and stuff, it just feels like that is not an aspect of this. This is like a presentation much more. And so there's less of that night to night, like, dynamics to kind of focus on, you know?
Yeah, definitely. You know, yeah, there's not that like reaction going on quite as much here. Yeah, I agree.
Just them chatting on AIM to themselves, apparently. All right, so on that note, let's dive into Helsinki from November 14th, 2016. And we probably, you know, we won't spend like a huge amount of time on each of the sets. We're already going longer than I anticipated, but, you know, it's just like, again, one long song. So, you know, sort of. But it's basically from the middle, again, November 14th, the middle of the 2016 leg. It's worth noting that this one seems to be particularly popular, probably because of that fantastic audience recording that started circulating the very next day, actually. It's got the second most ratings on Rate Your Music after Dublin, and it's currently sitting at a respectable 3.67. So, you know, how would you describe the sound and, I guess more importantly, the structure of this set in particular?
I think it's hard to not just repeat myself from, you know, our zoomed out discussion, but yeah, I mean, definitely, this is that academic kind of set. I think, this one is a little longer than, some of the other, you know, 2016 ones that we got here. Because of that, I think I'm trying not to jump ahead too much.
I think it's about average for the, 2016 sets. It's an hour two and we've got,
is it?
Yeah, it's about average for the, I mean, the 2016 sets, yeah, they're like kind of, they feel like basically a tight hour, you know, which is different from the 2018 sets we'll talk about. And yeah, I mean, I think all the stuff that we were talking about earlier about like the overall sound is, you know, just fits here. We move through sections of like, you know, lots of this kind of like bubbly, gurgling kind of stuff, big like kind of cello-ish drones and stuff like that. sometimes like big bouncy low end kind of floods in and then dissipates and stuff. But what's, I mean, most striking about this set, obviously, and all the 2016 sets, is that you kind of get this huge, like, I guess I want to say like one huge crescendo, but really there's a pretty substantial break in between them. But you kind of get this like sudden rush of, you know, like electro groove kind of going on in the middle with like this like monster bass riff and just like this, I don't know, these drums that are just like rapid fire kind of like tight kit, like full kit all of a sudden when it's just been kick drum the whole time. That happens. There's kind of a cool down and then you get these huge organ drums. But what's so weird about this set, right, is that this kind of happens in the middle, you know, and then we like go back off into the drift. You know what I mean? It's
yeah,
kind of like that's a strange structure.
That's what I was trying not to jump too far ahead on. It's a strangely structured one. It sort of peaks and then has, you know, 20 more minutes to go and kind of just peters out, you know, in this sort of academic abyss. I'll say that, you know, I didn't think that Helsinki was necessarily like one of the best shows because of that. You know, it sort of like hits
yeah.
it. Hits
I mean, but it's like typical for the 2016 show. I mean, I feel like all the 2016 sets, they do this. They kind of like blow their load pretty early in a kind of like shocking way. I mean, without even talking about like the 2018 sets, which, you know, we'll talk about it, but they move this to the end. But it's like, even if you didn't hear those, I think it would be sort of weird just how like amorphous and drifting while still kind of pulsy and moving like we were discussing, but then just like basically two violent eruptions of mm-hmm. energy and then like 20 minutes more of drift. You know, it would be strange even if you didn't know that the 2018 sets move that crescendo closer to the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's a natural, you know, sort of ending place, I think, like with those crescendos. And it was just sort of like, you know, you hit those and you're like, ah, yeah, you know, either like here it comes, you know, we're moving into this, yeah. you know, loud, you know, era or something. And then you just sort of go right back to where you were before. And it just sort of like, I don't know, took the wind out of the sails a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I guess I do just want to ask about these crescendo parts specifically. They're obviously fan favorites, these things. Listener Tyler wrote in to describe these two sections as, quote, a monster in all caps and way cool on the second one, the organ drones. So, I mean, what do you think? Do you love these sections?
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously like the, you know, kind of pieces of these sets that are easiest to, you know, grasp onto as something to, you know, talk about, you know, instead of this like amorphous, you know, blob that happens the whole time. So yeah, they're definitely cool and like attention getting. I love like you know, during the big like organ thing, like, you know, that organ noise is like the, you know, front and kind of obvious thing, but I mean, if you listen like closely in headphones and stuff, like it itself is sort of like morphing and changing like subtly. And then there's, you know, those kind of like weird gooey kind of sounds like behind yeah. it and everything, like it for like the one section that sort of seems the most like steady and unchanging, it like still is like doing like a lot of like, I don't know, modulation and stuff like within it, those sounds.
Yeah, I mean, they are kind of spectacular just for how shocking they are. I mean, what's striking to me is like that kind of like monster bass riff thing that comes in. Honestly, in the 2016 sets in here in Helsinki, it's like a little abrupt, I think, like almost awkward how this like kind of like grinding kind of riff like just, you know, launches in all of a sudden. And then, you know, but it's just undeniable that like when that kind of rapid fire, like tight drum kit beat like kicks in, it is just like such a huge rush. And it almost feels like all of that amorphous drift was worth it mm-hmm. for this takeoff that we are now like living in the middle of. So jumbly and frantic and everything. And, you know, but then it just sort of like peters out. And it just makes me think of like, okay, like kind of getting back to what I was like struggling to talk about earlier is like, you would want to say like, okay, well, that's a clear track. You know, that's where yeah. if I was going to draw track lines, like that's an easy one. And yet it doesn't feel like a well-developed track. You know, it is just like a takeoff. It is a buildup, and it sort of arrives at, you know, more like amorphousness. But You get what I'm saying? How like it's still not a piece. Like it's still transitional and like functional in quality, even though it's a big surprise. Its point, it only makes sense in the context of this whole piece. And I feel like the organ drones, same way. Imagine if they just released a track was just those organ drones. It would mean nothing without like this huge buildup. And with this huge buildup, it feels like a cathartic release. I mean, the fact that it's not the end is another topic, but you know what I mean? It's like, they're cool, but they're shocking, but they still feel like so woven into this.
No, definitely. I mean, they're the easiest place to like mark some sort of delineation because they have that like little element of surprise, you know? But you're right. You know, they are still like just moving to another place and are basically, you know, just another kind of transition.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's the shock that is exciting about it. And you don't get the shock without the rest of the stuff.
Exactly.
Listener Jordan wrote in to compare the 2015 tour with this one and wrote, the earlier ones were just blasting you with noise, but these newer ones have a mix of energetic tracks your body can dance to and tracks that your brain can dance to. This is more sound. There's more sound design going on here, and I'd say it was an improvement. We talked about that a little already, but Jordan's comment got me wondering, would you agree that there's like a nice mix between energetic and brainy tracks here? Or do these crescendos just like, despite kind of needing the rest of the thing, do they stand out too much? Does the whole set work like a satisfying whole?
I think it works as a satisfying whole a little better in 18 when it's been moved. You know, here on Helsinki, the 2016, you know, portions of the tour, I don't think, you know, it works quite that well because it peters out and you sort of have this cathartic thing and then, oh, you know, we're sort of back where we were before. So yeah, I sort of don't think that it works super well as a whole the 16 part.
I just think it's weird because, you know, when I, or maybe telling, honestly, it's like, when you look at comments and, you know, I'm looking at Ray Your Music, I'm looking at like R. Autechre and everything, like every comment is about these two sections, like every single comment, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody has shit to say about the entire rest of the set. And it's like they simultaneously need the rest of the set to make any sense and have that impact that obviously works so well. And yet it feels like they are the stars of the show, like, and almost steal the show entirely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting because, like, I wanted to read this from listener Phoenix, right, who, to contradict what I was just saying, wrote in to say, my favorite section is the outro to the 2016 sets. It's a mixture of 32A Reflected with the snare of the outro of SCH.MEFD2. It's simply one of the most gorgeous things Autechre have ever created. The uplifting but bittersweet melody and atmosphere is something that I believe AE have only really done a few times in their career, and that isn't even mentioning the textures, which are amazing throughout all the sets but truly shine here. That giant morphing static ball that consumes everything in all of the sets is pure ear candy. My favorite rendition is Oslo, simply for its outro, which sounds like the entire universe falling apart to just a singular gust of wind that's violently cut off. It's unbelievably beautiful. I mean, it's interesting because I agree. Like, I actually 100% agree that like this ending part of the, you know, 2016 sets, and I know he's talking about Oslo here and we're talking about Helsinki, but I think it's stunning. It's like next level sound design, this kind of like weird, I don't even know how to describe it, but there's like a kind of like clanging, like physicality to this, you know, that physical modeling thing of like this weird clanging thing, and actually like a lot of prettiness in the kind of like swirling. It almost is like one of the times where sound design and composition really come together on this set. And it's like just the most gorgeous, like next level piece. And yet I like forget that I love it so much because it feels like totally overshadowed by this huge crescendo that happened about the middle of the set. And then there's like a long stretch of more amorphous, like bubbling and gurgling before we then get to this thing. You know what I mean? It's like, it would be really impactful, this ending, but it gets overshadowed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think if it's either like a rare case of, you know, bad sequencing for Autechre, or, you know, if we just sort of got rid of those crescendos and you know, the that section, you know, the listeners talk about, like, sort of becomes the new, you know, not crescendo in the traditional sense, but you know, like the ending, I think it would kind of work a bit better.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just so torn because it's like, I can't deny that. I love that outro. I totally
agree. No, yeah.
But it's like, it feels weird because I almost like forget about it. And then once it finally like starts, and it's not so long, but it's like it finally starts and I'm like, oh yeah, like this does end like really beautifully. But I still can't help but feel like I still haven't recovered from the organ blasts even at that point. You know, I kind of wanted to ask a quick side question about that. Listener Tyler referenced this fan-made collection called AE16 Exclusives, which basically, I think, cuts up the individual tracks from the tour and assembles them into something like a new Autechre album. Shout out to Reddit user U Twist Rose for making it. It's quite an accomplishment. It's like actually very cool. But there, the big organ blast track is called Letteran, and it sort of resembles Letterel from Tripitae. In fact, after writing this, I found other comments where listeners were sort of speculating, like, is this a rework of Letterel? You know, Tyler writes, it's fascinating to hear modern Autechre's take on a Tripitae era track. What would the rest of Tripitae sound like if they were to modernize it like this? Yuto, Clipper, Rizdio, with all the new tricks Autechre has learned over the years, it would blow my mind. Rob and Sean, if you're listening, I really want to hear Tripitae 2021 mix. Is that how you hear Letteran? Like, it certainly has a resemblance to Letterel, but do you hear it as a reworking?
You know, I sort of, you know, you brought this to my attention so I could re-listen to the, you know, Tripitae track and stuff. And I thought, like, going into it, I was like, there's no way, you know, this is going to be some, you know, crackpot idea. And then, you know, I re-listened to it and I was like, oh, goddamn, you know, like, it really does, like, it sort of have, like, it sounds like the same sort of patch, you know, changed like it into this modern era thing, which is strange because, you know, Tripitae wasn't done in Max MSP, and I would assume that these live sets are. So I don't know if it's just like coincidence or what, but I mean, it definitely has like you know, a very similar feel to it.
Yeah. It's just like these, because it's like the use of these like kind of lush, glistening, like organy chords, you know. And in Letterel, they're using like quite a musical way, but they're still kind of punctuating, you know, the beat. And here, there's like no beat, but it's just like punctuations of these like big bursts of chords. But I want to say it's like an accidental resemblance almost. I mean, like the point of this is just like these huge, thunderous chords, and it's, I mean, honestly, amazing that like they keep getting fuller and heavier and like even more distorted as it goes along. And like those like kind of weird gushy and like whipping sounds like are building up and like getting more and more out of control. You know, it's like about heaviness rather than like actually like a pretty chord touch on Letterel.
I just feel like, you know, some of kind of what I was talking about before, like, you know, inside of those, you know, organ, you know, blasts, you know, there's sort of like these things like moving around and stuff, and I feel like in the background of Letterel there's sort of a similar kind of thing happening. I mean, it might just be, you know, parallel thinking with themselves, yeah. You know, kind of thing. I don't want to come out and say that it's definitely like conscious or anything, because it seems so strange, like, you know, to move something from completely different equipment, you know, just to do some, you know, little minute long thing in your, you know, 2016 yeah. set, and, you know, to see if some nerds on the internet recognize it, you know, kind of thing. But it, I mean, I think it's definitely like there's something to be said about it.
Yeah, it's uncanny for sure. You know, unfortunately, we didn't hear from any listeners, like I said, who attended any of these shows themselves. Though somebody did respond to you on Discord about seeing the Melbourne show and thinking it was incredible, despite a bad sound system, low volume, and an annoying crowd. But we did spend a little bit of time with the Helsinki audience recording, so I want to know what you thought about that. I also want to read this from listener Jordan, who writes, the good thing about having live sets like these is that I can try to simulate their live shows in my own house. I just turn all the lights off like they would have in their shows and play it on my loud system. I've never had the privilege to see the boys live, but at least I can simulate the live experience at home. It's not like you can actually see them live anyway or see them do any cool stage stuff because it's always dark. You have to listen to these sets in the dark like how it's meant to be played. So what did you think about the Helsinki audience recording? Does it feel like we're missing something important by not being there, or at least hearing it in the dark and on a huge system, as we sort of decided was the case with the first AE Live?
Yeah, on the first AE Live, I did think that, like, you know, hearing the audience recording was, like, pretty cool. It sort of gave you a sense of, like, the fun that was in the room. Helsinki audience recording, I just, because that this is, you know, such a more academic set, I didn't feel like I gained much in the audience recording. If anything, it was like a little annoying whenever you would like hear someone talk or something, and then you know, it would almost like take you out of it,
because I think people are a little bored, and then there's like screams in between each organ, you know, blast. And I mean, some people like that, I guess, because it's kind of funny that, I don't know, just instinctively everybody seems to do this at these shows. But
it just always sort of like, I mean, when I'm personally like at a show and, you know, it's something that's like strange or something, it's like people there that like didn't really know what they were getting into. You know, maybe they had heard Tri Repete or something, and they thought they were going to the club, and they, you know, they got this, and it's like they don't know what to do, so they either have to chit chat or, you know, scream in between stuff, and it's just, it's not like appropriate for the music, and it just sort of annoys me.
I mean, you just get this feeling that, like, when, you know, when that first like kind of monster bass riff starts, and when the organ blasts start, that, you know, people are like so excited that something is happening.
Yeah.
You know, finally, exactly. They've just been kind of sitting there, like listening to just, you know, just in a wash of like soupy electroacoustic stuff. You know, that they kind of just like scream out, and I don't know, it does sort of like detract from the experience in a weird way. But like we were saying earlier, I guess something that I have come to understand, but that you still don't get from the audience recordings, is apparently just how shocking these, you know, pieces were. Like, you know, people were saying, I guess we talked about this with the first AE Live, but like there's something about the room's ambience where, you know, some of these like flickering sounds and stuff were actually felt like they were bouncing around the room, you know. And I think Autech are very careful to actually mix for the venue, so they know that there's going to be reverb in the room, and so there's probably less on the actual sounds than what they wanted, you know. So there's that element, but there's also the element of, like, I think from what I understand, like the silence in between those big organ blasts was stunning, you know, like just how huge the sound is and then utter silence in between it, you know, despite those kind of like whipping, like gushy sounds that sort of build up. You know what I mean? Like that's something that you don't get when you listen to soundboards, but you also don't get when you listen to the audience recording. It's just something I can only imagine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're exactly right. You know, it's that kind of thing that like you just can't, you know, it's just impossible to capture outside. I mean, there's a reason that, like, you know, live albums haven't replaced, you know, actual, you know, live concerts or anything, you know. It's just there's parts of it that you can never fully capture at home.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like in contrast to the first AE Live, there's something about this where you don't feel like you're missing something really important. Like,
no.
You know, it almost feels like, you know, you are getting it, because it was meant to just be like, you know, sit there, shut your eyes and like focus, but
You
are also missing some things.
You're definitely getting like a bigger chunk of it in these ones than I think, you know, maybe you're getting 90% of it here and you're getting, you know, 75% or 80% or something, you know, in the old ones. So I agree.
Yeah. So kind of a related question that we started to touch on earlier is like, how do you explain the 1/6 legend that seems to start growing immediately? I mean, isn't it kind of perplexing because of how weird these sets are? Like, listener Eric wrote in to say, not having attended any of these shows in person, I can't say how well this material worked for people standing in clubs, but for home headphone listening, I absolutely love it. On the other hand, listener Joe wrote, I can't help but feel like you had to be there. I get the feeling that this music is meant to be felt, and that it would have vibrated and overwhelmed you and evoked feelings that just aren't possible to be felt on headphones or with a living room stereo. A lot of the music sounds weirdly empty and like something is missing, and I think part of that is the natural reverb that would have been heard and felt in the room itself with the booming sound system. You know, we talked about how the previous AE Live is maybe not well suited to headphone listening, you know, compared to the club experience, but is 1/6 different? I mean, do you have any temptation to say that like it would be weird to be, you know, watching this at a live venue?
No, I mean, I definitely think it would be, especially now with the knowledge of it, you know, being for seated venues. I think it would be pretty cool, you know. I mean, because you would get that, like, you know, physical sensation of the bass and the, like, natural reverb of the room and all. And I think that, I mean, that definitely is like a portion that is forever missing, you know, here and will always be, you know. So yeah.
I mean, but does it reward the headphone listening?
I think, yeah, it definitely, like, rewards headphone listening. I think more than the 14-15 sets did. You know, the 14-15 sets I sort of like enjoyed listening on my speakers more than I enjoyed listening in my headphones, and these sets were honestly like the opposite. I felt it like at work and stuff when I would listen to just on my speaker, it was sort of easy to stop listening, you know, like have it just become
zone
background
out.
Exactly what I was looking for. Whereas, like, you know, in headphones, you could sort of feel that stereo field more and, you know, maybe get those, like, deeper sounds that you wouldn't catch, you know. Because that's the other thing. In headphones, you can make it louder. And this set, like, definitely feels like, you know, volume would help it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a weird thing, or maybe actually not weird at all, but just, like, it feels like you either got to listen really close or you got to be there. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I just have it like playing on my speakers or something, it's like I do sort of, it just like washes over me. I kind of like lose track of where I am all the time. Not that it's not enjoyable, but it's like I enjoy it a million times more when I'm like, when I've got my headphones on and I'm like literally just shutting my eyes and just like paying close attention to it. You know, if you were at the venue in the dark, it kind of forces you to do that. Mm-hmm. And then plus you get like the huge sound system and everything. It's kind of like, you know, I don't know. You know how every movie is just like better in the theater? Maybe you disagree with this, but it's just like being in a movie theater, granted, if there aren't annoying people there or whatever, it just like forces you to be in a dark room looking at this huge screen. You are not going to check your phone. You're not going to get distracted. Like, you literally can't look away from this enormous screen. That's like the live experience, you know? Whereas like if you're watching on Netflix or something, you're like, you've like just realized like, oh shit, I've been on my phone for like the last 20 minutes. I don't know what the fuck's going on. You know what I mean? You either got to do the headphone or you got to be in the theater.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I mean, the same thing with the, you know, the live show. The audience can be the annoyance that takes you out of it.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely get that with the movies. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if I was sitting in this venue, I wouldn't be doing work or, you know, playing on my phone or anything. You know, I would just be paying attention. Whereas, you know, here you can zone out because, you know, you can have your attention taken elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to quickly read this comment from listener Joe, because it sort of touches on what we were saying earlier. He writes, when Autechre famously said that they had music that made Confield sound like pop music, I think they easily could have been referring to this. I can't imagine how someone who had heard Yuto and Clipper on YouTube and decided to check the gig out must have felt after about 10 minutes of some of the most abstract electronic music out there. Yeah, very true. It's fun to imagine that there were some of those people, although I'm sure they got a kick out of the two big crescendos we were talking about. So, you know, moving along, how would you sum up your thoughts on Helsinki? Is its reputation deserved, or is that mostly just due to like the very excellent bootleg that people got to hear first? What?
I think it didn't seem to like particularly stand out to me in the, you know, 16 sets. I think, you know, it's the most famous one because it's the one, most people heard first. To be honest, you know, the 16 sets all seemed, you know, a bit similar. You know, like none of them really, you know, it's not like, oh, I prefer Oslo to this one. You know, I sort of just, you know, they just sort of all were about as good as each other, if that.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't feel like huge differences in quality between them. The 2016 sets, I enjoy listening to pretty much any of them. I feel like Helsinki is, you know, just as good as Oslo, just as good as Zagreb, whatever. But it's like, you know, I guess as some of my thoughts, it's like, it's weird how the crescendo does sort of overshadow everything that follows. But there's something to be said about the way that, like, about the time where that kind of bass riff thing kicks in is when I'm feeling like I need a shakeup, you know, like it kind of like hits me right when I'm like starting to kind of lose focus, and, you know, it's like wakes you up. It's like a shock to the system. I even like how like there's like a section before that has this kind of like beeping to it, and it just feels like almost like an alarm, like, hey, you know, snap out of it because you're about to get like knocked on your ass with this next thing. there's something about the timing that works, even if it's like, you know, and again, I love the outro of it a lot. It's I don't know. I just have mixed feelings about it, where it's like a fascinating set in the sense of how it crescendos early and does these like big surprises, but they're only surprising because they happen early. Really. It's like, that's what makes them so surprising. So I have a hard time criticizing it for that, because it's also something that makes it so interesting, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, let's fast forward to the very last show here, Dublin, from July 15th, 2018. I alluded to it earlier, but I should mention this is both the most rated and the highest rated 1/6 show on Radio Music at 3.82 out of 5. It's also the longest by a decent margin in this batch, 5 minutes longer than Melbourne and almost 20 minutes longer than any of the 2016 sets. Listener Joe observed that in both 2014 and 2015, and the 2016-2018 collection, the Dublin show is by far the longest of them all. In fact, it's the only city I believe they played on both tours. I wonder if they have some special connection either with Dublin or Ireland in general. It sure does seem like they have some affection for Dublin, doesn't it?
Yeah, I you know, that is strange, you know, to I always wonder, you know, when there's one set that's, you know, a bit longer or something, like what spurred that? You know, why is it the crowd? Is it the city? Is it the venue? You know, I would like to know that.
Yeah, I feel like they must like it. But how would you describe the sound and structure of this set? What has changed from 2016?
I think from 2016, it's like clearly, you know, been refined a bit, and either just from the previous tour, or, you know, in back at home, you know, in the studio or whatever. I think the track listing or whatever is much better here. I think it flows better, it works better. I'll say I greatly prefer the 2018 shows.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it is basically, I don't know, it feels more developed in some ways, in the sense that we basically start off with, I think, something that's just completely new, and like quite a huge section of what I was alluding to earlier. It's like this kind of water drip sounds, and it turns into like something that kind of sounds like a, I don't know, like a clock ticking or something. It just has like this nice kind of, actually, it's funny because I think that the that AE16 exclusives collection, this, you know, person just like came up with their own tracks, and they call it Clock Tower 4, this piece. But it has like this great kind of like clicking, like kind of water drip pulse to it. And it all just forms into like this wonderful thing. There's like even like these kind of like light jazzy chords that are kind of like interspersed in the thing. And I mentioned earlier how it becomes like this nice little bongo groove, even though it's like, you know, just buried in like these cello groans and stuff. I mean, it's like it's just such a like gorgeous opening. It leads you through into like the kind of shim ripple casual section, which we didn't talk about enough, but we will, but it's like, you know, the other big monster piece. We get into column 13 territory, which is new here. You know, and it just feels like overall we're spending a huge amount of time in the kind of amorphous territory, but it somehow feels, you know, more developed. Like it feels like these are like, instead of a couple aborted ideas here and there, it feels like each thing that they move along to is like very fully considered and like fleshed out and explored before we get to those crescendos. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what I meant by it being, you know, a bit more refined. It does sort of feel like they're more steady in what they're doing. Like there doesn't ever seem to be like an aborted idea or something that they, you know, bail on quickly or anything.
Yeah, well, let's address the elephant in the room. You know, we read listener Phoenix's praises for the end of the 2016 sets, with which I agree. And he added, if there's one thing I have to nitpick about the 2018 sets, it's the lack of this ending part. On the other hand, listener Eric wrote, the 2018 sets are my favorite because of how well they're structured. I think it makes a lot more sense having the climax at the end rather than in the middle. That whole section is just fantastic in all of the sets, but I think it lands especially well when it makes up the last 20 minutes of an 80-minute journey. Listener Joe also wrote, the Dublin show seems to have a much more structured flow to it than the 2016 shows, which sound far more amorphous to my ears. So I guess we know what side you're on, but why do you think those crescendo sections work so much better at the end?
It's just a natural way to go, you know, like you to build up to something and then, you know, have this release is, I mean, what Western music is built on, you know. I just think it in one hand, you know, I appreciate doing something different, and, you know, not just falling for that trope or whatever. But then again, the trope sort of exists for a reason, you know, it's not like, you know, some stupid sitcom thing. It's something that's basically been ingrained in our culture for 200, 400 years or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I will say that, like I was saying earlier, there is some, something interesting about doing these parts earlier in that they are like a total surprise, and it actually surprises you no matter how many times you listen to the 2016 sets, like just how early the crazy takeoff starts. But I feel like they definitely deepened and improved it in the way we were just talking about with like a lot of the sections here. That first like monster bass riff part, they just like improved it immeasurably in my ears. It's like, they, instead of like just this bass riff sort of like starting out of nowhere, it starts off like much more gently, like with this, like a lot of low pass filter stuff going on where it kind of like creeps in, and it just feels like a much smoother transition. And then as it starts to take off, like when those punchy drums come in, you know, it just like carried you in there instead of just shocking your systems, which maybe is smart since it's going to be like more of a crescendo kind of a thing at the end, you know what I mean? Than like a surprise in the middle. I also feel like they made it much more unhinged. Like there's something about in the 2016 sets how it's like, oh shit, we're doing like an electro takeoff out of nowhere. Here, it's like quite wild. Like those drums are like more blown out and more harsh, and like they are tripping all over themselves in like an almost untilted kind of way. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't sound like just a straight electro track was inserted in the middle of this electro acoustic soup.
No,
it sounds more like a natural part of the overall feel.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, like even in those organ blasts, like they do that like morph thing, you know, way more, you know, there's like some static almost in it and stuff.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, I do miss like, I mean, there's lots of little things that we could like go on and on about, but like in the 2016 sets, there's this nice like these wind chimes. I mean, it literally sounds like it's so well done. It could just be a recording of wind chimes. But in the 2016 sets, there's like these wind chimes that kind of like follow after that first like bass riff part, and they start to form into like a really like gorgeous Midori Takata kind of a like minimalist composition or something for a bit. So here you lose that section. I mean, you hear the wind chimes, but it just becomes part of like this, like the cool down of like between the two big crescendos. You know, on the other hand, you get this like incredible kind of build up before that monster bass riff part that like, it just feels like everything is pitching up higher and higher and like starting to feel like a rubber band is going to snap. But instead of like going straight into the monster riff, it like pauses for this kind of like gorgeous little section, you know, before that monster riff then creeps in. I mean, again, we can get into all the details, but it's like, I'm just so torn because there's like things I love about both of them. And in a way it feels predictable to like all lead up to this big organ blast, but it also works better. I guess I don't have a question, but I just feel like a lot more torn than you do. It sounds like,
yeah. I mean, I get why you're torn, and I agree. I mean, it is interesting to not just do the logical thing of building to this conclusion, but like I said, I mean, there's a reason why that's the logical thing. You know, sometimes when it's not broke, you know, don't fix it.
Yeah. I mean, anything else you like really like or maybe even dislike about Dublin?
Nothing I really dislike. You know, I think really just anything. Excuse me. Anything they, you know, they've sort of just improved on that 2016 set. Just made it smoother, more refined, flow better. You know, I think it's all improvement. I mean, so much so, honestly, when once, you know, I finished listening to the sets and was just focusing in on the shows, I had to like, you know, force myself to not just pick Dublin over and over, you know. You know, I had to like consciously go back and forth between the two.
Yeah, I mean, I also want to say it's like great to hear Column 13. It sounds absolutely awesome in this set, and it's like, you know, I mean, maybe they hadn't composed it yet or something, but it's just like mind-boggling that it wasn't always a part of the set because of how perfectly interwoven it is into this Dublin set. And like, there's something about it that is, I don't know, just so fascinating because it's like, it feels like a little bit more new agey and like meditative than it does on the NTS sessions. Mm-hmm. It's like there's like these big kind of cosmic swells and everything to it, and it's just like, I don't know, it's just perfect. The same thing with, like, I mean, we didn't talk enough about Shim Ripple, but it's like really cool to hear Shim Ripple in both 2016 and 2018. I mean, there's something like, it's Shim Ripple, but like those kind of weird twisted bass groans are like kind of cooled down a little bit, and then there's kind of like a bouncy little beat underneath, and then some kind of like scattershot, actually, you know, high percussive hits and stuff that like kind of, I don't know, in the 2016 set, they feel like a little bit random, but here it kind of like forms into like, so I want to call it a remix of Shim Ripple Casual, even though this may have preceded the one that we got on NTS4, but it's like, I don't know, it's cool. It's really cool to hear those two tracks, especially on Dublin.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's interesting to hear how, you know, like they don't just play album tracks live, but you know, when they do, they still kind of aren't, you know, they're always like changed in some way. And it's like a, it's the kind of the only glimpse we ever really get into their like, creative process, I think.
Yeah. Might be a good time to return to the first AE Live before I ask which sets you like more. I want to know what you think about the whole like sort of slow developments here versus the hard cuts on the first AE Live, or as Sean and Rob put it, curves rather than discrete events. You know, does the overall flow work here? We were talking about like the kind of surprise of those crescendo parts on the 2016 sets. They're like less of a shock to the system here, I think, because, you know, even by the end of the set, I think you're expecting maybe not organ drones, but you're expecting some big pop at the end, I think. You know, so I don't know, which you like more, AE Live or AE Live 2016, 2018?
I think I like the first set more, 14, 15, you know, I think they're just more like fun to listen to, but honestly, it's pretty close. You know, I definitely like enjoy these sets too. They're just kind of in a different way. And I think, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, I could listen to a couple of the 14, 15 sets in a row or, you know, in a day, whereas these ones, I couldn't do that at quite as much. But I definitely, it's a close match, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like these significantly more, honestly. I feel like, you know, there's something about AE Live where it does give me that feeling that, like, I think it was listener Joe that was describing earlier that, like, you had to be there. I mean, the first AE Live, it just gives me this, like, oh, I wish I was, like, in a room with, like, a bunch of other sweaty people. You know, like, that it's just, like, this barrage of energy. And I don't know, I just, like, when I'm listening to this on headphones, like, listening closely, like I said, I mean, it just feels like endless depth. And I agree that, like, on the 2016 shows, some things, like, don't always, like, come to fruition. But, like, on the 2018 shows, I mean, I feel like it always does. It always, like, pays off. And, it again, just, like, I cannot emphasize enough how, like, fascinating it is to hear, like, Column 13, right? There's, like, those kind of drippy sounds, like, return. And it feels, like, sort of amorphous and weird. And then it starts to become the kind of, like, clock-ticking rhythm of Column 13. And all of a sudden, like, it comes into focus and the whole track makes sense and it's amazing. And you just realize, like, holy shit, like, they planted that seed 10 minutes ago with the sound. And now here it is paying off. I mean, there's just so much of that going on. That's, like, just stuff I love, like, sitting at my desk and just, like, paying super close attention to. You know, I want to return to the question of the night-to-night developments by reading this email from listener Sean, who writes, "To me, it sounds like the tour starts out pretty straightforward, all things considered. Beats are in a recognizable shape for the most part. The opening sequence, it sounds like slow-mo, sinister samurai doom hop is so mind-blowing. I feel like they really hit their stride in Tallinn and Helsinki. This opening sequence is particularly strong there. Then it seems like a pretty drastic shift happened for the Oslo show and everything after. It sounds like they added a layer or two of abstraction and continued to do so until the frenetic Dublin set. As the contours get a bit less defined and sound design progresses and hits higher highs, by the time Dublin comes around, it feels darker and most of the set is unrecognizably abstracted, though you can still hear traces of the earlier iterations. It's such a cool release to me because the shows have that evolution. It's hard to pick a favorite. Each of them has their strengths, and you have to listen to all of them to understand the set on its own terms." You know, we talked about it, but now that we have kind of talked our way through these two versions of the set, is this how you hear Dublin? Is, like, kind of the culmination of a tour-long development?
I think it's easy to like say that with Dublin, you know, because it's the last show. I feel like 18 is sort of like, you know, the culmination of that 16. Like it's just been refined and whittled down to, you know, like a better form. I mean, I did think that Dublin is like clearly the best show, you know, in this whole thing. Whereas like Helsinki, I feel like just sort of got picked because it had a famous bootleg. I feel like Dublin like actually earns its spot, and I think that's because of the refinement.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it feels more like, because I sort of disagree with the listener in the sense that like I feel like the night to night on the 2016 thing is just like really minor differences, like maybe like, you know, people tend to call like Oslo like the more ambient one or something, and I guess I can hear that, but it's like you get the overall impression that maybe it was a little bit more soupy than like Helsinki was or something. Sometimes they like nail the transition a little bit better than others. Sometimes those like organ drones like kick you in the ass much harder than other times or something, but they just feel like isolated experiences. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a pause, and then in 2018 they reemerge with this set that's been fleshed out, and I don't know. I don't know if I can commit to the idea that like Melbourne is just as good as Dublin, but it just feels like the 2018 is the culmination, even if it wasn't like a linear development. So I guess I want to ask if you have any closing thoughts on Dublin. And I was going to ask if it deserves its reputation as the very best performance, but it sounds like you do think that.
Yeah. I sort of skipped ahead, I guess. But I definitely like think that it does. You know, this one, I think it, you know, Melbourne is good too. And we only get two 2018 sets here. But, you know, Dublin, it's a bit longer. It sort of feels like they're having more fun. You know, maybe that's just me reading into it or something. But I think it definitely like deserves its spot as you know, the highlight of this set. You know, like if you truly only have time to listen to one or something, you know, that would be the one I'd recommend. I do think you should listen to all of them, but Dublin is the clear favorite here, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to ask next, is like, you know, if Dublin is so obviously the best, is this like the one that people should start with? I mean, I kind of want to say no. I kind of want to say you know, they're all like rewarding to listen to, but you don't have to listen to all of them. But I would definitely kind of do what we did, which is like, mm-hmm. listen to a 2016 set, get to know it inside and out, and then listen to the 2018 sets. The 2018 sets are more exciting because you hear how they sort of like fleshed out some of these things. And like I said, made that like, you know, wild electro takeoff part like just a little weirder and more unhinged and like better woven into the fabric of this set. You know, you hear that stuff, but you also like, I just feel like you don't want to miss the surprise of those 2016 sets, how weirdly constructed they are with those like crescendos in the middle. So, I mean, what do you think? You think it's like what we did is what listeners should do if they've yet to listen to this one, pick a 2016 and pick a 2018?
Yeah, I agree pretty much with what you said. I mean, Helsinki and then Dublin are good ones to pick. I think, you know, you can't really go wrong with a 2016 one. They're all sort of equal on equal footing, but yeah, I think it definitely makes it interesting to see what changes and how it changes.
I just thought it was funny like thinking about like how to get into this. It's like, it's not like the first AE Live, and maybe just my Americanness is showing, but it's like in that one you can like pick some city that you have a connection to or something, like just mm-hmm. pick that one and do it. Like here it's like I think a lot fewer people are going to have connections to these cities. But again, I might just be an American idiot to make a quick Green Day reference on this podcast. So again, just wrapping up here, I want to kind of return to the question quickly about like, why does Autechre or why does AE Live 2016, 2018 seem so overlooked, especially in comparison to the first AE Live? You know, do you think its reputation will improve if we do get 20 more sets or something like that?
I think the real reason it's kind of overlooked is that it's not on Spotify. You know, it's harder to access in this like physical sense. You know, if you either have to pirate them or, you know, have paid for them from the Bleep store. I think if they were on Spotify, you know, more people would be aware of it. You know, even I think I'm sure there's people who aren't you know, that are Autechre fans, but, you know, maybe aren't, you know, just rabid music fans or anything, and maybe don't know that they came out. I mean, if you don't hang out on, you know, the Autechre, you know, subreddit or something, like, I mean, really, kind of, how would you know that these came out? I don't remember a lot of press on them.
Like I said, there were like no reviews.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. I don't think Pitchfork said anything about it. I mean, maybe the Wire didn't even review these or anything, you know. I mean, it was sort of in the height of the pandemic, when I'm sure, you know, all these magazines and stuff were working with, you know, as few staff as possible and everything, so it really did sort of slip under the radar. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people, you know, more casual fans, kind of don't even know these exist.
Yeah, well, I guess that is a good point. So maybe they will kind of grow in stature, or maybe they will grow in stature if we do get more, even though I don't think that's necessary. But yeah, probably when they are more accessible, more people will hear them. You know, I mean, the question is 1/6 essential listening?
Always, you know, I think this is always my answer. If you're listening to this podcast, yeah, like, obviously.
Right.
You know, to the casual fan, I think it would depend. If you really like NTS4, or if you, you know, have an affinity for, you know, pre-craft work, electronic music and stuff, then yeah, definitely. If you're a person who just likes Tri Repete or Amber or something, maybe yeah. Not, you know. But again, if you're listening here, then yeah, go listen to them.
Yeah, I mean, kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier, which is like, it feels so apart from Autechre's discography that it's not like you need to hear this to understand,
correct?
You know,
yeah.
The rest of the albums or anything like that, like. It still feels like this kind of shadowy, like, glimpse at a distant future of Autechre or something, or like a weird one-off maybe as more time passes. But it's like, you know, you don't need to hear it to understand Autechre. But yeah, it is a treat if you're into like NTS4 and some of the weirder stuff on LSEC and stuff like that. Just wanted to read this from listener Joe, who says, "Overall, I feel the same way about this live set that Dan feels about Untilted. I'm blown away by its complexity and enjoy listening to it from time to time, but it gets to be a bit too much after a while. I'm sure that you guys will be massive fans of creative and unworldly sound design. Probably you'll probably enjoy it a lot more than me, and I very much look forward to hearing your takes on it." So, coming to that now, how did it go these past 2 weeks? How would you sum up your feelings on AELive 2016/2018?
Yeah, I mean, it went fine. It was nice. I hadn't spent a ton of time with these, you know, like, for the reasons we talked about at the top of the show and stuff. So it was nice to sit down and, you know, really kind of dive into them. You know, maybe listening to all of them in a short stretch of time wasn't the best way to take it in, but I did enjoy it. I mean, particularly once I zoomed in just on Dublin and Helsinki.
Yeah, I have a hard time summing up my feelings about it, because, like I was saying earlier, I mean, I love, like, zooming in on it. There are parts, like this listener was just saying, that are like, the sound design is next level, like, absolutely lots of parts like that, honestly. But mm-hmm. Then there's like just as many parts that are like, again, weird aborted experiments or something. There are points where I'm like, you know, checking my watch a little bit, because it's been a long time since anything happened, you know. So it just feels like not everything totally works, but there are like these incredible moments of just like, again, otherworldly sound design. A couple big surprises, maybe not quite enough big surprises, you know, but I don't know. So just sort of mix. So I guess we can sort of answer it by like, where did this land in your running rankings of everything we've talked about so far?
Yeah, I put it just actually right below the other AELive sets. So it came in at number 14 in between Garbage and AELive 2014-15.
Yeah, I put it like, I don't know. I don't know if I feel good about this, but I put it at number 11. Which is like right below Sickly Sweet, right above Gantz Graph. You know, the first AELive is down at number 18 for me. I just kept feeling like there's so much here, even though like not everything works. I mean, I feel like almost like the hit and miss ratio for me personally is like, you know, I want to say like half of this is some of my favorite shit ever, and half of it is stuff that like, you know, is just okay, like in sort of an academic, like I'm studying Autechre kind of way. And yet, like, some of those just moments are like so mind-boggling that, you know, I was just going through my list and being like, if I was stuck on a desert island, would I want like LP5 or would I want this? And I was like, I kind of want this. Like, I feel like I would never get sick of it. Just a quick side question from listener Sean, who writes, the guys mentioned in an interview that they had a live setup for Sign Plus all ready to go. Think they'll play that one or start something fresh? Excited to see what they've been up to over the past year. Of course, we have no way of knowing this, but do you think being in lockdown, they've just been tinkering and like, we'll never get to hear the Sign Plus set?
I mean, from what I know of them and stuff, it seems like, yeah, we'll never hear that. They, you know, they don't seem like someone who's like, oh, well, damn, we didn't get to play it. We'll wait until, you know, the pandemic's over. I'm sure, especially, you know, in lockdown and stuff, sitting at home, I'm sure they tinker with it. It would be cool if they, you know, released it in some form, as the original one, but I, you know, basically highly doubt we would ever get that.
Yeah, I'm sure they couldn't resist just fucking with it. And you know, in some ways maybe we'll just start with the 2018 version, you know, so to speak, of the 1.6
set.
Yeah. You know, we'll just start in Dublin on this next tour and maybe go even farther from there. All right, any closing thoughts on this chapter of the Autechre journey?
No, I'm excited to, you know, get to Sign and Plus.
Me too.
All right, well, what do you think about AE Live 2016, 2018? We're going to do another listener episode, email episode next week. So send us your thoughts, gauntcastpod@gmail.com. Next proper episode in 2 weeks, Sign and Plus. We want your opinions, hot takes on those, gauntcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out, subscribe, leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Look us up on YouTube, stay connected, Twitter, Instagram. Both those are @gauntcastpod. And we'll see you next time.
See ya.